Bill Russell is going to continue the Paula Gordon Show with Carl Savina, and the question was?
A lot of these discussions, you know, particularly from the fishery standpoint, revolve around economics. And what stood out in the contraposition, the juxtaposition of these two fishing fleets, fishing areas, is that the people in Alaska are making more money, they're catching fish. The work is not as bad as it used to be. It's much improved over what it used to be. All of which goes to the well-being of the fishermen, and to the well-being of that way of life. And again, go the next level down with the details of what happened with that. I mean, how they managed to turn around what could have happened. I mean, obviously the same thing could have happened in Alaska that happened in the North Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is effectively the North Atlantic, at least this side of it, and probably, I guess, all over, has essentially crashed in big portions of it.
It has crashed on the American and the European side. And there are still fish, and people are still catching them, but at a tremendously reduced rate. Most of the fish populations that people most care about making money off of are down around 90% from what they once were.
And there's only 10% left.
There's only 10% left on average of a lot of the fish that are most economically important to people. There have been tremendous changes.
Like?
Cod is, you know, the big one from the North Atlantic. And people in the North Atlantic wherever, not just in the Alaska region, but wherever people have worked to reduce effort and rationalize the amount of fishing power based on the resource, the people are doing much better. And the resource is also doing much better. And
is this like living in balance with the planet?
It's like living in balance with your bank account. It's like living off the interest instead of spending all the capital. Where if you live off the interest, you will have the interest in perpetuity. And if you spend all the capital, you'll feel a lot richer for a short while, and then you'll have nothing left. And that's the way the fisheries have been prosecuted in much of the world, the North Atlantic being the prime example under discussion here. And people haven't realized in the North Atlantic that when you defend your fishing deteriorates, and when you defend your fishing improves. But in the Pacific, they always held the line on how many fish they took out of the ocean. And then what happened was it got more and more people tried to get in, and there was so much crowding that the seasons had to shrink to be shorter and shorter seasons, so that the total amount of fish taken out never exceeded the capacity of the fish to produce. In the North Atlantic, the more people that got in, the more fish came out. In the North Pacific, they held the line. But then the competition became so absurd that some of the seasons were down to like one day twice a year, and something had to give. Either they were going to just let them totally have at the fish, which would have destroyed the resource, or they had to do something to get most of those people out of fishing. And they simply set up a quota called individual transferable quotas, basically saleable, ownable shares of the quota, so that shares went up for sale and people could either sell out or buy in. And most people got out, and a few people bought big. And there are now a number of boats that reasonably and rationally match the number of fish that can come out. The fishing is much safer because they can choose their days now. And when I was there, for instance, there was a huge storm was about to get hurled at us. And a few years ago, we would have had to hope to survive the storm. And instead, we just ran into port. And it took a couple of days to get to port. And then when the weather got nice, the boat went back out. In the past, boats would have sunk in that storm, and other boats would have been badly beaten up. So, you know, things are much better there because people had a much more rational approach, and they found something that worked. But exporting that has not proven stronger than the traditions of demolition that have held sway in some of the other parts of the ocean.
As you tell that story, and my reading of it at least, it sounded as if, I mean, there's a tendency to talk about the ubiquitous they, and what seemed interesting is that some, you know, there were key individuals who actually did things, who initiated actions. and that those few individuals really did have a substantive impact, that it wasn't just a matter of the government or some UN agency or the great public, that a few people did some things, and it really changed the future of the community and of the environment.
That's true. As Margaret Mead said, it's usually a small number of people that change the world. And that was true there as well.
One of the many striking things you say in Eye of the Albatross is there is no longer anything that you can say is remote, that remote has kind of gone away. I get that sense both as you talk about the oceans and as you talk about the sky, the air over the oceans, that there's no remote in terms of distance linearly, in terms of up and down, that we have to care about all of it now.
Well, we affect all of it. We affect most of it without caring about it or without thinking about it, but we do affect all of it. There's really no place that you can go where the things that live there are not feeling the effects of humanity in some very substantive ways, mostly having to do with the transport of chemical pollutants or plastic that gets into their diet and their food, or just the change of climate that affects the entire world. And in the 80s, Bill McKibben wrote the book titled The End of Nature about climate change, and the title refers to the fact that people always thought that you could affect some things, but certainly the weather was part of nature. And more and more I'm impressed with his choice of title for that book, because more and more it's really clear that there is nothing in the world that is just natural without feeling a significant effect from people.
I was struck by the tangible manifestation of that. You talk about, what by any standard is a remote island in the North Pacific, where you would think it would be about as pristine as any place on Earth. The scientists that are there have created piles of plastics and other things just that routinely routinely wash up on the beaches, and it's not an isolated or an event. It is a continuing state that the oceans are apparently awash in particularly plastics as well as chemicals, but those are less obvious.
And well, then there's this incredibly heartrending story of an albatross mother trying to feed her baby, and all she can get up and can't get it up is a toothbrush.
They swallow plastics for reasons that are not entirely clear, but probably, I think, because... and they also swallow pumice, which is a type
rocks.
Of volcanic rock that is so shot with air, it's spongy and it floats. So these little rocks are floating all around the Pacific, and the birds eat them as well. And I think they probably eat them because there are enough living things accumulated on them that if you swallow them and you digest the living things, you can cough up the pumice. The pumice is always smooth, round, little floating light stone. But there are other things that are now floating around, and I think that the birds just swallow these things, and they're like cigarette lighters, light sticks from longline fishing operations, things like toothbrushes. That was one of the hardest things to watch that I ever saw, this bird having come thousands of miles, being at sea for weeks, trying to feed its chick, and then getting stuck on a toothbrush that it couldn't quite pass because it had its neck arched. And you could see just the tip of the toothbrush, and the chick is trying to eat, and the parent is struggling with this thing that is so wrong, it was almost disorienting to see it. You kept looking at it thinking, is that really what I'm looking at? Is that what I'm really seeing? And but the most startling thing about the remoteness or the lack of remoteness is that people who were looking at the accumulation of pesticides in birds around the Great Lakes, which everybody knows the Great Lakes have pollution problems, and the eagles and the cormorants have pollution problems as a result of the fish that they eat and all the toxic chemicals they accumulate. Those scientists went to the islands in the North Pacific to compare the polluted Great Lakes birds to the pristine albatrosses of the North Pacific, and they found very similar levels of pesticides in birds that they thought were going to be their remote comparison, and that was very startling to those scientists and, sort of an awful surprise.
So there's no getting away from these questions.
There's no getting away from them. You can ignore them, but other creatures are suffering the effects.
And then we get to pay on the other way back.
Yes, we do.
All of those things we can't eat and all of those things that die that will affect us as well.
Okay. The bird doesn't get tired. The bird doesn't get zapped by the storm necessarily. And again, I'm thinking of albatrosses because I have a particular affinity for one particular albatross.
And you did that, Carl Savina.
But how do they get home? The navigational piece of this is I think, it's almost incomprehensible.
And we'll try to comprehend it when we come back in just a moment. Please be with us when Carl Savina tells us how they get home on The Paula Gordon Show.